they were prepared to take real risks with radiation in particular, and with some of their explosive experiments, because they felt that they were being kept back from the front lines, where their brothers and their fathers and so forth were risking their lives in a very direct way to do this other thing that might shorten the length of the war and save lives. And they felt that they should take whatever risks they needed to take.
Hello, and welcome to My Nuclear Life. I'm Shelley Lesher. Today, I'm continuing my conversation with Richard Rhodes, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book, Making of the Atomic Bomb. As mentioned, it was impossible to include the full conversation into one episode. In our last episode, we explored the beginning of nuclear physics as a field and the first efforts in Europe to explore the possibility of building a bomb. In today's episode, we will discuss the building of the Manhattan Project infrastructure, including Oak Ridge, Hanford, and Los Alamos, but we'll end before the scientists begin their work at Los Alamos. There is one more part of this discussion, which will cover building the bomb and the end of the war. But before we begin, I wanted to let you know that part three of this interview won't be released until season two of My Nuclear Life. This is a continuation of a conversation I had with Richard Rhodes. Where we left off, the scientific community knew a nuclear bomb was theoretically possible, and they were convinced it could be built if the government dedicated resources to the project and went ahead with a full-scale industrial program. This project was voted on the day before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Once the U.S. was in the war, it was full steam ahead.
I don't think anyone had really envisioned the scale yet. For that, you needed the Army Corps of Engineers.
They are big thinkers.
And of all the people they chose Dick Groves, this 6'3", 240-pound, slightly overweight, dominating engineer who, in the way of the peacetime military, had studied at MIT more than once, had taken all sorts of advanced graduate courses in engineering. In addition, he had just finished building the Pentagon, and he really finally got the concept of a nuclear weapon a year or so later when he thought about what one bomb would do to his Pentagon. The Pentagon's just sitting there looking like a place where you drop a bomb in the middle.
It does look like a bullseye a little bit.
Yes. And he had also, perhaps more to the point, just finished constructing most of the new military bases and most of the new armories where the bullets and the shells would be made all over the United States. So he was a large-scale operator. And he did it really out of his back pocket. His staff all through the war, when he was running the Manhattan Project, the largest single project of the war in terms of dollars spent, he had a secretary who was a really efficient Smith graduate, and he had one major who worked with him who would be given assignments like, oh, go get my blouse cleaned, his military jacket. He'd hand him his military jacket and say, get this clean this afternoon. Because Groves lived on trains. He just spent his days going back and forth from, there were now locations around the United States where the bomb was being worked on in one way or another, mostly the science at this point, and the early part of the industrial. So Fermi was at Columbia. There was an operation going at the University of Chicago that was basically what Los Alamos would later be, where they were working on the theory of how you design the bomb itself, what a critical mass would be, and so forth. There was a big operation out at Berkeley where they were discovering plutonium and trying to figure out how to enrich uranium using an electromagnetic separation system that was basically a spinoff from the cyclotron, which had been invented at Berkeley in the 1930s. That's one way of bombarding nuclei before the neutron came along. So there were these various locations. That's all that was up at that point. When Groves came along, the first thing he did, he was a colonel. And he told the general who told him what his new assignment was, make me a general immediately because otherwise I won't have any authority to get this stuff done, which they did. So Major General Leslie Dick Groves now, the same day that he was given the assignment, when he was meeting with all the top honchos in government, former president of Harvard, James Conant, and others who were the overall civilian leadership of what was taking shape as the Manhattan Project, he left a meeting with them abruptly saying, I've got to catch a train down to Oak Ridge. I've got to look at some land down there where we will build our factories. And he took the train to Oak Ridge and immediately bought up three valleys. Oak Ridge is a series of ridges along the southern Appalachians. And he wanted a place, he had two requirements, at least 200 miles inland so that theoretically no foreign bombers could bomb it. And in this case, a place where each of the various large factory systems he knew he would be building could be isolated by the mountain ridges from each other. So if one blew up, a real possibility, it wouldn't blow everything up. So there were these three parallel valleys between ridges in the Appalachians in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and he just bought them.
And he went down to Oak Ridge. Was this the day after?
No, the day of. He met with Conant and the other people who were going to give him his assignment. He basically said, thank you, gentlemen. I know what I need to know. I've got to go catch a train. And they were like, well, he really is sufficient, isn't he?
So Groves went at it immediately. He knew immediately what to do and just went out of the gate and was ready to go.
He had the concrete flooring of his factories laid before he even knew what machinery would be going in them. He got order of magnitude estimates from the scientists. And he just immediately started pouring concrete. He was a marvel, and he really is the unsung hero of the Manhattan Project because, I mean, Oppenheimer is always the one who gets all the credit, and he did some interesting things. He ran that small part of the Manhattan Project where the actual weapons were actually designed and built, and that was, of course, crucial work. And there were some real setbacks that I don't think anyone but Oppenheimer could have handled. And he almost resigned in the middle of one of them. We'll discuss it. But Groves was the one who could see the whole. Remember, by the time this project was at its full operation, counting construction workers and everything, 600,000 people were employed by the Manhattan Project.
And the scientists were only just a small fraction of that.
Yeah, there were some hundreds. I don't know the exact number, but just some hundreds. There weren't, you know, physics was a new science in those days. Luis Alvarez, a Nobel laureate who worked on the bomb and did some interesting work on the bomb, told me that when he got his PhD at Berkeley in 1937 in physics and when he went to cocktail parties and people asked him what his field was, he said, I'd tell him chemistry. I said, why, Louis? And he said, because if I told them physics, I'd have to explain what it was. So take that and then jump to the end of the war, where C.P. Snow, the British physicist and novelist, commented, in 1945, physicists became the most precious asset of every nation state in the world. That's the heady experience these people went through. Thank God they were mostly very stable people.
Yeah, I really don't feel that way as a physicist in today's world.
Right.
Contractors must have hated Groves with him, you know, building buildings before they even had plans.
Well, they did, but they loved him because he had a lot of work for them.
I suppose.
But let's take DuPont. DuPont Chemical was the company that he wanted to build these giant production reactors. He picked out a huge piece of land in eastern Washington state, most of it barren desert, but with the Columbia River winding through it, this big, rich, clean watered river coming out of the mountains to the north, because the reactors were going to need cooling water. And they were so big, and he was going to build three or four of them at least, that he needed a river. So here was this great setting. There were some Native Americans who lived there, and he made a deal with them that they could come and fished salmon once a year, as long as they trucked it out of the reservation, the bomb reservation now, not the native reservation. And they agreed and so forth. And he got rid of the few farmers around and started that operation going again before they'd even built a chain reacting reactor yet. That work was going on in Chicago now. Fermi was moved to the University of Chicago when the University of Chicago became the center for the physics part of the operation prior to the development of Los Alamos. So he moved from Columbia. They moved all his graphite. They moved all his uranium and set him up, of all places, in a disused double squash court in the basement of the disused football stadium at the University of Chicago. Chicago, famously a very intellectual university, had given up sports at the beginning of the Depression because it didn't think it could afford them. And here was this empty stadium with these empty, very conveniently sized courts down below, squash courts. So that was just the right size for the reactor Fermi wanted to build using graphite and natural uranium.
I really like hearing a school giving up sports and giving all the facilities to their physicists.
Yes, isn't that lovely?
Yeah, I think that's a model we should look after, definitely, a model we should go for.
The only catch was that the squash courts were cold. It was winter in Chicago, and winter in Chicago is a bitter, bitter time.
Yes, it is.
These were unheated rooms. So these guys were lugging bricks of graphite about the size of shoeboxes, a little bit bigger, down an elevator into this room and stacking them. I mean, Fermi decided to call this invention a pile, because it was literally a pile of graphite bricks with holes drilled in them in what would, if you could see through the graphite, form basically a spherical configuration. And into those holes would be dropped slugs of uranium, basically like that tank of water that Fermi and Szilard had worked on in New York years before. This was just going to be bigger. And Fermi did the calculations and roughly estimated that he would have to build something about the size of a two-car garage in order to get enough uranium in one place to prevent the loss of neutrons out the edges of the reactor. As it turned out, because Szilard was still out there, now Szilard was working on getting better and better quality uranium. And toward the end of this process, we're now in 1941, they started building the pile in October of 1941, having built a lot of these Fermi exponential piles previously, so that he'd gotten his measurements all laid out. Now they started building one that would actually chain react on its own in October of 1941. And by then, Szilard had found sources of uranium metal. And oxide, of course, is much less dense than the metal form. So you could get more neutrons out of the metal, if you will, than out of the oxide. And they stacked the uranium slugs in the middle of their new pile. And instead of being a sphere, they were able to top it off in the form of what I think is called an ovate spheroid, meaning shaped like a doorknob. It was lined with boards, raw pine boards, to hold the stack of graphite together. So from the outside, it just looked like a giant stack of wood. But there was one control rod which ran in and out of the very center of the pile that was used to control the reaction, and that Fermi very carefully marked off in increments and so forth. Control rods in those days were pretty primitive. When I visited the Kurchatov Institute in Moscow many years later, they still had their original pile going, which was actually a copy of a small pile that was built at Hanford in Washington State to use to measure the purity of the uranium that went into the big piles. So someone at Hanford was a spy. He's never been identified. In any case, the Soviet little reactor had a control rod set up in the top, and the control room was above the reactor on the second floor. And when I was taken up there by the old engineer who still ran it, used it for experiments and to make medical isotopes, he showed me their control rod, which was attached to a knotted rope.
That does not seem safe.
which went over a pulley, and then you just pulled up the knotted rope, and the knots told you how far out the control rod was. It was built in the middle of Moscow. We're still operating 75 years later, so clearly it was safe, but it sounds pretty heroic when you think about it. And let's stop for a moment and talk about this. Once the war began for the United States, and the scientists were drafted into this project, they were prepared to take real risks with radiation in particular, and with some of their explosive experiments, because, as several of them told me, they felt that they were being kept back from the front lines, where their brothers and their fathers and so forth were risking their lives in a very direct way to do this other thing that might shorten the length of the war and save lives. And they felt that they should take whatever risks they needed to take. And there were times when people would have to take a couple of weeks off because they'd been exposed to too much radiation and they were feeling the effects, and then go back to work.
And I hear people ask or talk about how scientists didn't understand radiation at that time. And
oh, yes, they did.
So this is clearly a story in which they did understand the effects of radiation.
Sure, they did. They had been working with radiation. There'd been a lot of work with radiation. Radiation had been the main method of treating cancer during the 30s. There were famous needles of radium that Marie Curie supplied around the world from her work purifying radium at the institutes in Paris. She made these available, and people would raise money to buy one needle of radium for their local hospital to use in cancer treatment. So people were aware of it. They may not have been aware of the effects on large groups of people. Some of the people who went in after the war, Philip Morrison, told me that he met a Japanese scientist radiologist who said to him, I mean, the Japanese were very polite about everything after the war, but this man looked him in the eyes and said, well, yes, we experimented on rabbits in the 1930s. It remained for the United States to perform the human experiment. And yeah, that was a very chilling statement, and that was about as much anger as anyone showed, because the emperor had said, the war's over, treat these people well. But there was plenty of knowledge of radiation in those days. In general, people were prepared to take more risks with it than they would be later when all sorts of other rules came in. For example, Luis Alvarez told me that when he was teaching physics at Berkeley, he would swallow a glass of uranium nitrate or something and then trace the course of the material through his body with a meter to show his students how it went. So they were taking risks that perhaps would no longer be allowed, to say the least.
Yeah, I'll certify you can't do that anymore.
They knew what they were doing, and they all died of old age.
So were they going for speed instead of safety?
Yes, inevitably. John Wheeler said to me, I had a brother who was fighting in Europe, and he was killed in 1944 in the Battle of the Bulge. He said, I grieved that if we had worked a little faster and a little harder, started a little sooner, my brother would still be alive. So they were keenly, keenly aware. And, you know, I think people don't realize today, I was a little boy in the Second World War. We played in the streets because there weren't any cars. You couldn't get tires. You couldn't get gasoline. They were all rationed. So the streets became playgrounds. But on every block, there was at least one window where there was a black felt banner hanging with a gold star on it. And that meant some member of that household, a father or a brother or a son, had been killed in the war. So we were aware of the stakes. And really, until 1943, the newspaper headlines basically said we're losing. And in a way, we were losing until we cranked up our vast machinery of manufacturing and began turning out bombers at the rate of one a day and battleships at the rate of one a week. It's incredible what the United States did. There's a story about Winston Churchill when he heard the news of Pearl Harbor. turned to his aide and said, "The Lord hath delivered them into my hands." And his aide said, "What do you mean, sir?" And he said, "Now the Americans will have to come in the war."
Wow. Well, it worked.
The manufacturing capacity of our country would be turned to this challenge. And ultimately, in those pre-nuclear days, the way you won a war was to make more bombs and make more planes and make more ships and make more tanks than the enemy could make. And then you could take over whatever you had to take over to get them to surrender. That's the way wars used to be fought. The bomb changed all that.
Well, and it wasn't just the American scientists that, you know, were invested. There were a large percentage of the scientists were from Europe.
It was really fortuitous that Hitler had basically expelled all the Jewish physicists and chemists from Germany because they found their way to America, which welcomed them. And early in those early days, even particularly before the war began for the United States, we were working on radar. Radar was what won the war, really. The bombs just kind of finished the war. But it was radar that made it possible to imagine trying to shoot down a plane when it's 3,000 feet up and it's going at 240 miles an hour, and all you've got is a cannon, and you fire it up, and it took an average of 3,000 shells to hit one plane once. And even then, maybe the shell wouldn't bring it down. But then with radar, and particularly with something called a proximity fuse, which was a little tiny radar unit that could fit in the nose of an artillery shell, of an anti-aircraft shell, and made it possible not to have to actually hit the plane, but just get close to it. And then the radar would read the fact that there was a plane nearby and set off the explosion. Once the proximity fuse came in 1944, then the problem of anti-aircraft was basically solved just in time, because by then the Japanese were sending young pilots over in flying bombs, and they were destroying our Navy in the Pacific Ocean. And the proximity fuse made it possible to shoot those flying bombs down before they hit the ship. Otherwise, we would have had another debacle in the Pacific in those years. People don't realize how much this was a science war. It was the first war where science was really, in many ways, the decisive issue. And mostly because of radar and the proximity fuse, also because of a lot of other inventions that came along, but those in particular.
So science won World War II.
It certainly had a major role in winning World War II. Let's put it that way. We lost a lot of lives, and the British lost a lot of lives, so I mean, the fact is the Russians won World War II, at least in Europe. We didn't. We didn't come in until very late in the war. They lost 25 million people in World War II. 25 million people.
Yeah, those numbers are staggering.
Yeah. So to go back to General Groves. Okay, so what he decides is, once he's been briefed by all these scientists, and he's pretty gruff with them, he tells them, he's actually, of course, a little insecure with them. But the first time he meets with all the guys in Chicago, he says, "You know, I probably have the equivalent of about three PhDs. So I'm in charge here." And they all looked at each other like, "Who is this guy?" But he was in charge, and he put himself in charge, and he stayed in charge. Once he got the briefing on what was possible, there were basically three tracks to enriching uranium, which was at that point, or to making bomb material, let's put it that way. There was electromagnetic isotope separation, which was being worked on at Berkeley, and which was prodigal of electricity, but was a way you could do it. Basically, you separated uranium atom by atom in a magnetic field by making the lighter atom curve a little closer in than the heavier atom, or vice versa, whichever way it works. And then there was gaseous diffusion through a membrane. Mm-hmm. And there was what was called thermal diffusion, which was basically running the gas through a tube that had hot and cold sides and the isotopes would slightly separate according to the temperature. And then you could sort of pull them out the top and then run them by again. So these were the methods. And then, of course, with the discovery of plutonium, another method came along, which was to breed plutonium in a nuclear reactor. And for that, someone had to prove that you could make a nuclear reaction in a reactor. And that was Fermi's work at the University of Chicago, Fermi and Szilard. Fermi and Szilard had a patent on the first nuclear reactor. They invented the nuclear reactor. They were paid for their patent at the end of the war, something like $500,000 each. Pretty cheap, really, when you think about all that's followed.
Absolutely.
So they, in the July of 40, worked out how you'd build a reactor. And after that, the whole thing was, as I said, Fermi building exponential reactors and Szilard getting the materials together. But they still had to build one that would actually chain react, and that was the work in Chicago. That reactor went critical early on the afternoon of December 2nd, 1942. It was like 0 degrees outside. It was a cold, cold day in Chicago. Everybody in the basement in this double squash court down under the stands of the football stadium at the University of Chicago was in overcoats and sheepskins and whatever they could pull together. And they pulled out the control rod, zip out. Fermi called it a zip. He loved American slang. He called it a zip out, he said. And they began reading the meter, and the meter started clicking, and then it clicked faster. Pretty soon it was just a roar. They had it, and Fermi said the reactor is critical, has gone critical. They ran it for 4 minutes. It was generating about enough energy to light a flashlight bulb. It was unshielded, didn't need any shielding, wasn't that big an operation, but they did prove that you could make a chain reaction. And if you could make a slow chain reaction in a reactor, then you could certainly make a fast chain reaction using highly enriched uranium. And thereby, they showed that with the reactor, it was already clear that with such an operation, you could make plutonium. So then Groves began building. He built these huge plants down in Oak Ridge to isotope separate uranium. He built these huge power reactors, basically they were production reactors up in eastern Washington. And at some point realized that he was going to need some place to actually build the bomb itself, the physical weapon. So far he'd concentrated on making the materials. The discussion was that they would do it at the University of Chicago. But by then, Robert Oppenheimer, this brilliant theoretical physicist from Berkeley, had become part of the discussion. He had been someone who had been used to think through some of the questions on the physics side, because he was a very brilliant physicist. Hans Bethe, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, told me that he said Robert was so much brighter than the rest of us. That's pretty amazing coming from Hans Bethe, who figured out how the sun works, right? He worked out the thermonuclear reaction that powers the sun. That was what his Nobel Prize was for.
It's also something because out of all the people involved, Oppenheimer never won a Nobel Prize.
Well, and Robbie discussed that. He said Oppenheimer was scattered. He was someone who always wanted to be on the cutting edge of everything. He basically was someone who wanted to always look like he was smarter than everyone else. He was a bit of a brat. He really was. He'd certainly been a brat as a child. Nobody liked him. But he learned to sort of control his brattiness, except he was always saying snippy things to students who got something wrong. And even to Bethe. Bethe said he could be sharp. He said he was even sharp with me when I said something stupid, Bethe said. And then we all say something stupid at one time or another. But when Groves came along, Oppenheimer clearly realized that Groves was the key to the whole story. And he made himself, as someone said, Groves's idiot manquet, idiot cretin mathematician, if you will. Whenever Groves wanted an explanation of anything in the physics world, Oppenheimer would give him one clear, straightforward, in English, in a way that Groves could instantly grasp and understand it. And for that, even though Oppenheimer had never run a laboratory before, had never been in charge of anything before except his classes, Groves chose him to run what was going to be this new place. Oppenheimer had argued that the physicists who were going to build the bombs needed a place where they could talk to each other, where they could abandon compartmentalization and all get together and discuss the problems and work through them together. And Groves was very suspicious of this. He thought secrecy was of tantamount importance, and he didn't want a bunch of, as he called them, eggheads and crackpots getting together and talking all the time instead of getting back to their benches and working. But Oppenheimer was one smooth customer, and he convinced Groves that they needed such a place. And Groves's requirement, however, was that they would have to be put there for the duration of the war, surrounded with barbed wire, and not allowed to leave. So where would such a place be? Well, Oppenheimer had a ranch up at 10,000 feet in the Pecos Mountains north of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he had loved to take multi-day riding trips with his friends on horseback, carrying along nothing but whiskey and chocolate bars. They would go off on these 2 or 3 day adventures. And he had encountered along the way a private boys' school on a what's called a mesa, on one of the projections off of a huge volcanic caldera to the west of the Rio Grande, basically just opposite of his ranch and the other range of mountains, the Sangre de Cristos. So about, you know, 30, 40 miles away from there. And they rode up. The first place they looked was down in a valley, a canyon, and it was depressing. There wasn't any sunlight. It was clearly not a good place, except Groves realized how secure it was. He liked that part of it. But then they went up to the top and looked at the ranch school. And here was a place that could be isolated. It was a flat area. You could surround it with barbed wire. And it was sunny, and there was already a emplacement of school buildings there to use as the first operating center before they built the buildings they were going to build. So Groves bought the ranch school that day, kicked out all the students and all the teachers, and that became the famous Los Alamos. The only problem is it was in the middle of a national forest. There was one telephone line. And they were proposing to build basically a major physics laboratory there with a cyclotron and linear accelerators, whatever they needed. It seemed crazy. And the only road up to Los Alamos was a dirt road that went right along the edge of the mesa. I mean, even today, when it's a finished asphalt road, you drive it and you are worried that you're going to fall off. I mean, the wall is straight up on that side of that great protrusion. So it was terrifying, but that's what they decided. So Oppenheimer said once, my two great loves were physics and New Mexico, and I'd always wanted to find a way to bring them together. So he succeeded.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, Los Alamos is still very isolated today, and it's the modern age, and it's still isolated.
Well, they love it up there. It's a beautiful place, and the sun shines, and you can see for miles. But all of a sudden, these German-Jewish physicists and Hungarian-Jewish physicists who had escaped, some of them, concentration camps in Europe, found themselves stuck in the middle of nowhere in a national forest, surrounded by barbed wire again. And some of them commented on how disturbing it was for a while until they got used to it, to be plunked down in the middle of nowhere and not allowed to go anywhere and not allowed to communicate with anybody except through censored mail. I mean, people had a lot of babies during the war at Los Alamos. There wasn't a lot to do, so they made babies a lot. Groves at one point even called in the doctor who ran the clinic there and said, I want you to do something about all these babies. And the doctor said, General Groves, I can help with flu, I can help with measles, but I'm sorry, I can't stop people from making babies. So
that seems like something General Groves would not like.
And in fact, there are a number of people who proudly showed their birth certificates. They were born in a post office box.
And that's where all the mail went and all the babies were born. P.O. Box, 1663, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
How does one go about recruiting scientists for a top secret project?
Well, and this one in particular, because it was absolutely secret. Oppenheimer, when he began recruiting scientists for Los Alamos, could not tell them what they would be doing. Well, how do you do that? These are people who are teaching. They have deferments in order to continue teaching because someone had to teach the generation that was coming up, even though there was a war on. He would call up some graduate students or a young assistant professor, but typically graduate students, find out who the best ones were at all the schools, and say, let's take a walk around the campus. And they'd walk around, and he would say, I'm recruiting people for a secret war project. I can't tell you what we will be doing, but I can tell you that it will probably end this war, and it may end all wars. And that was enough. They signed on. I mean, many of them, of course, quickly guessed what was going on. What would it be that would be so enormous that it might end all wars? Well, nuclear weapons, presumably, and in a way they have, and at least world-scale war.
Could he tell them even where they were going or what the climate was like? I mean, anything?
They would learn where they were going when they were handed their train tickets.
But before that, during recruitment, they couldn't say, like, you're going somewhere warm or...
No. But again, these were smart people. As soon as some of their friends were down there and they started getting letters, they checked the postmark. It said Santa Fe, New Mexico. They pretty quickly realized that's where they were going. It was where everyone else had gone, so presumably so were they. And they all traveled down to a train depot in the middle of nowhere. To this day, the train doesn't go to Santa Fe. It stops at a station outside of Santa Fe, which was in the middle of nowhere. And you got out and put your bag down and sat down in your bag and waited for a Jeep to come and pick you up and then take you into Santa Fe, where there was a recruiting sort of setting up office just off the main plaza in Santa Fe, where a very personable woman from Kansas City, Missouri, my hometown, would help them get settled and tell them where they were going and get anything they needed and then ship them up to the Mesa, or as they quickly started calling it, the Hill. They always called it the Hill, just as Oppenheimer said, let's not call this thing a bomb, let's call it a gadget. So Los Alamos, which has taken over the story, and I don't want to leave out the other parts, just a couple of details. I think if one imagines these huge industrial operations employing thousands of people, none of whom know exactly what they're doing, you can get some sense of the sheer scale of making this very rare and precious material. For example, the electromagnetic isotope system needed big metal bus bars to carry a lot of direct current into the calutrons that would make these powerful magnets work. And typically those would be made of copper, but copper was very much in rare supply during the war because it was used to make bullets. And we used a lot of bullets during the war. So General Groves thought about, well, what other metal would work as well? And he thought, well, wait a minute, we're not going to use this ridiculously prodigal system that uses enough electricity to light a major city after the war is over. So he called up Fort Knox and said, I need, 15 tons of coin silver. And after they picked themselves up off the floor, the guy at Fort Knox apparently said, General Groves, we normally speak in terms of troy ounces, not in terms of tons. They shipped the silver down to Groves, and he had these giant bus bars about the diameter of a shoebox running for long distances around this machinery made up into bus bars, and they ran throughout the war. And then he returned it all to Fort Knox, and there were only honest to God, only a few ounces missing of the whole huge amount that he had used.
That's amazing. And it also says something about his ingenuity and thinking outside the box and, you know, the ability to account for every single thing.
And amazing when you think that he had just two people working for it. It was all done with messages sent, you know, by wire or whatever around to various people, and his personal traveling around the country by railroad train day in and day out. He'd go from New York to Chicago, from Chicago to Oak Ridge, from Oak Ridge to Santa Fe, and then back around and out to Berkeley, and then back around and around and around. And he would stop at a train station, let's say Chicago, and pick up the people he needed to talk to, and they would ride with him down to Santa Fe, and then they would get on the next train back to Chicago, and he would go on to Berkeley. I mean, he just, he was an immensely efficient, smart man who knew how to, as we said in those days, and kids won't understand this phrase, he knew how to get the spam to the front lines. And spam in those days was tin ham, not stuff on your computer.
So it doesn't sound like General Groves really liked to delegate things. He liked dealing with them himself.
I think he liked supervising and keeping track. No, he did. He did the other thing that really good managers always do. He chose first-class people to run things for him. That's why he could work with such a small staff, because he had Arthur Compton at the University of Chicago, a Nobel laureate who'd already run laboratories around the country. He had someone like Oppenheimer at Los Alamos, and so on and so on. He had the very best people in every place, and he had them sufficiently cowed, if you will, to realize that he was going to be on their ass if they didn't get the job done the way they were supposed to. And don't forget, and it's really important because I think we've all lived so many years with peace, and a lot of that really is because of nuclear weapons, I'm sorry to say. It's a terrible way to run the world, but that's the way we avoid world-scale wars anymore. We've all had so many years of peace that we've forgotten what a war is like. I was out. I was a Boy Scout. So was my older brother, Stanley. We were out collecting tinfoil from old cigarette packages or wherever you could find tinfoil. There wasn't much aluminum around in those days, and they used aluminum for planes. So there were tinfoil drives. We'd collect it up and ball it up and take it to school. We collected newspapers. And we took those to school, and those were some, I don't know what they were used for. We collected bacon grease out of the kitchen because it was used in the manufacture of explosives. At least we were told it was. I don't know. There was always the question later whether all these activities were just to keep us all engaged, and I have no idea. But we were all committed to this huge, it was the time when the United States did more recycling than it has ever done since, because we all wanted to make this war over. We wanted it to end. We didn't want any more of our relatives killed in the war. It just shaped our lives in a way that I think no one can easily imagine now. And we were lucky. We weren't being bombed. I think we had a keen sense of that we were safe way over here the last time, truth be told. Because once nuclear weapons and missiles came along, the United States was no longer this isolated place. But at the time, we were safe, but our loved ones were not. And we did everything we could.
And I think that is hard for us to understand now, how terrified everyone was at the time and how much that propelled the work.
Yes. Well, there was so much talk during the earlier part of the war, up through around 43, that totalitarian governments were more efficient than democratic governments. It sounds hilarious now. We have some idea of how that isn't true, of how if you concentrate all the power in one or two people, if they make a stupid mistake, they really pay for it. I mean, when Adolf Hitler decided nuclear atomic bombs were a joke, the war was over. I mean, the war was over anyway in Europe, but we certainly would have bombed Berlin with our atomic weapons if Germany was still fighting on when we had them ready. you don't easily run governments that way. The United States, just everyone pitched in every way they could. Also, remember, and this is something I heard from people at Oak Ridge, we had just finished the Great Depression. Everyone had been broke for the previous 10 years. No, there, you hadn't even had the money to go to a movie, or at best you could do that. All of a sudden, there were payrolls. There wasn't anything to spend your money on, so you bought war bonds. It was a way of keeping down inflation, but everything was rationed. We lived on 4 ounces of meat a week. World War II was won with cheese and macaroni. That's all we ate from day to day, macaroni and cheese. And once a week, we got maybe a little hamburger. So,
you just described the college kid diet.
Well, in this case, not because we couldn't afford it, but because it simply wasn't available. In fact, when General Groves was trying to recruit construction workers to build the plant at Hanford, Washington, with all those big reactors and all the other buildings there, it wasn't going to be enough just to give them money, because they were already making enormous amounts of money. Everybody was being paid royally for their work. So what else could he give them that would entice them to move to some godforsaken barren place and live out of tents for the next year? He offered them steak every night for dinner, and recruits poured in from all over.
Could they bring their families, or was it just them?
Well, both. There were a lot of men who were in construction, either because they were a little too old to go to war, because they were deferred. So there were a lot of men. And in fact, the other enticement was, we're going to have bars. And they built a bunch of bars. And they actually had tip-up windows in the back of the bars so people could jump out at night if there was a brawl going on.
Oh, my. So that was the place to be. You could get a beer and a steak anytime you wanted in Hanford.
Absolutely.
At the time.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
So they spared no expense. Groves spared no expense. I mean, to any one of these projects would have been a multi-billion dollar project, multi-million dollar project. Well, here, I'll give you the number. From a laboratory bench in Nazi Germany in December 1938 to 1945, we expand from that bench to an operation in the United States as large as the U.S. automobile industry.
Wow.
In terms of investment of money, in terms of number of employees, in terms of sheer physical plant, the Manhattan Project to produce 3 bombs was as large as the automobile industry in 1945.
And that's 7 years.
Yeah, just extraordinary. It just tells you what happens with wars. An awful lot of science gets done during wartime, I'm sorry to say, and an even larger amount of technology. You know, you think of the things that were developed during the Second World War: radar, microwave, jet planes, atomic bombs, and on and on and on. All of the early antibiotics, first mass-produced antibiotic, which was sulfa, came into use in the military in 1943. It had previously been used very rarely at the end of the Spanish Civil War in just minor doses that became available from the discovery was in 1937. So over and over again, you get these stories about just what a change of scale everything was during the war, and how much creativity under pressure went into all of this.
I remember from your book, I always say this quote to my students, that the saying was, time was more important than money.
Yes, again, because time was measured in human lives, in the lives of people you loved and your friends.
And that is just something, as you said, in peacetime, that we just can't fathom.
Right. No, it's very difficult to fathom. The only thing I can think of maybe is this COVID epidemic with people, your loved ones since getting sick and so forth. But even then, that's not the same scale.
No.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode and all the episodes in season 1. We would love to hear from you. Please send email to mynuclearlife at protonmail.com, and we'd appreciate it if you rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. When you subscribe, you will automatically receive the third installment of the Richard Rhodes interview in your podcast stream when it becomes available. Again, special thanks to Dick for being so very generous with his time, and Lexi Weghorn for all of her help with this podcast. Thanks for listening, and tune in next season when we will begin a discussion on the scientific ingenuity which created the bomb and the unfortunate end. I'm Shelley Lesher, and this has been My Nuclear Life.